Hi everyone, my name is Hadley Fisher and welcome to Resilience Agenda Radio. At Resilience Agenda, our big idea is mental fitness, the mindset, process and strategies you can use to develop, maintain and improve your mental health in an uncertain world. I'm with Kristen Lee, who's a psychologist, resilience and behavioural design expert, hilarious TED talker and author of the book Mentelligence. She joins us from Boston. Kristen, welcome.
Thanks, it's so great to be here.
How are you going with COVID? How has it challenged what you believe about resilience?
Yeah, thanks for asking. I hope you and yours are well and your audience as well. And, you know, certainly I think of it as a test of a lifetime. I think this really is the ultimate resilience and mental fitness test for all of us. And, you know, overall, I feel like one of the key words is vacillation. It's like we're going up and down a lot, you know, trying to sense make, trying to grapple with difficult emotions. But I think in that also look for the bright spots, look for the opportunities that come with this and, you know, looking at how it's exposing so many of our broken systems and so much of what we need to change in society. I think this can be a real moment in time in which we rethink the way that we've done things and the way we've built our systems on really inhumane ways. And I think that really gives us a chance to think about what do we want to do moving forward? How do we align our values to behavior, which science shows helps promote resilience? And how do we really even go to our own deepest kind of mindfulness and resilience practices to stay well and to do well, even in the face of like uncertainty and chaos and fear and anxiety? We are wired as a species to be resilient. And so I've been holding on to that. And of course, I've been, you know, just busy out there trying to help people rethink resilience and get to a better place.
Let's start basically. What is resilience? Typically, it means bouncing back. These days, though, we're talking more about bouncing back to a different place or a better place to move through adversity. Let's say you lose someone who you love or you lose your job. You won't necessarily go back to the same place, but we move through it. Talk us through that.
I love how you frame that. I think, you know, when I listen, I hear kind of a key word come up, which is agility. So being very adaptable in the face of chaos and adversity so that you can return to a version of homeostasis. But again, like you said, it's not really a new normal. I have like a little aversion to like the idea of normal anyway. But it's being able to come to a place of presence and purpose and intentionality and the best well-being that we can find given our context. I'll also say, like, when we think about rethinking it, I think we have to think about what resilience is not. So resilience is not a singular effort. So what I mean by that is, like, resilience doesn't happen in isolation or in hiding when we pretend we're fine or we fake it till we make it or we don't acknowledge our difficult emotions. When we're hiding out, we don't necessarily, you know, we're not able to leverage, you know, the healing that's available to all of us. I think resilience is also not something we're born with or we're not. So I think people have these romanticized ideals that like, okay, I'm just going to be a strong person or a tough person or the smartest person in the room. And this is how it is. And this is how I am. Brain science shows us about plasticity. So our enduring ability as a species to be able to be wired for adaptation, for healing, for growth, for new discoveries, for innovation, for creativity, even when we're walloped, even when it's like, oh my, like, because I think that's the burning question of today. Like, how will we make it? And like, is it even possible to be resilient? I don't feel resilient. So could I even be such? So I think we have to think about those myths of resilience, you know, those like little popular romanticized ideals about it and realize that resilience, you know, is very much in context. And again, like, I think so much about our social context and whether racism or classism or sexism or heterosexism, ageism, ableism, things like xenophobia, like there's so much that occurs in our context that calls us to have to be resilient in the first place. So we can't just pretend when we see individual success stories that those other conditions don't need to be dismantled and renegotiated in society. So I think that's the other big thing. People think it's just me, myself, and I, but resilience is really a collective effort. And a we effort, not a me effort.
A lot of people might think about resilience as something a bit fluffy or something that HR is pushing at work, but it's just a bit obscure. They're doing their jobs and focusing what's urgent. For people who haven't got a resilience plan or who don't think about their mental fitness already, why should they bother?
I think, you know, it always draws back to the data. What the World Health Organization is saying is that by 2030, that we're going to see ongoing catastrophic mental health outcomes, that lifestyle sickness is going to surpass communicable disease, and that, you know, we're living in this global mental health crisis. So, and the key thing is, when we look at the data too, is a lot of times we don't know how stressed we are until we physically get sick. So that's like a key thing. So a lot of times we might not have thought to construct a mental fitness plan or a strategic well-being or resilience plan because we felt like we were coping decent and we felt like we were fairly adaptable. And I feel like in my therapy room, this is something I always saw, you know, and I always felt like prevention is less costly than repair. Like, don't wait until that point of crisis to reach out. But I think, again, whether it's because of gender or culture or other variables, sometimes it can feel very stigmatizing to reach out and say, hey, you know, I need to cry uncle here. This is hard. I need help. I think in general, lots of us are wired to want to give help, but it's hard and it's humbling to feel like we have to ask for help. And I think that's a key part of it. And then just in general, I don't think that educational institutions or society has been set up in a way where enough time has been made for mental health. It's been sort of this other, like, let's add this on as a crisis service or as a footnote. And what I think we need to do is really pull it in and integrate it throughout our whole way of being to recognize we can stay mentally fit. And it's not rocket science. It's not hard. It doesn't mean that you're like, I think a lot of the old stereotypes, people would be called crazy or weird or psycho or mental or like all the stigmatized ways in which people are framed, when ultimately a sign of strength and resilience and fitness is being proactive and making sure, like in a fitness regimen, it's not like you're going to go out and run 26 miles in one day. You're going to build up to, you're going to have little things you do to get fit and to then sustain that effort over time. And the same is true for our well-being. But I don't think we're taught that way. I think it was always kind of so taboo that people didn't really have the opportunities to learn how to be strategic and integrative about it.
One of the things I find out there with what we hear about mental health or with content online, it appears that advice seems to talk to the lowest common denominator when it comes to explaining self-care or well-being. You know, a lot of it sounds really basic and people overlook it because they've heard variations of it before. And, you know, if you've got a job where you get some exercise and you know you should eat well, you know, it's all really easy. But people often say, well, mental health is for those other people, or I'm not that bad, therefore it can't apply to me. How can we talk about mental health, therefore, in a way that encourages people to be interested in it and to really make it a genuine habit?
I love it. I mean, I think like there's a couple of things. One is identity. I think a lot of us don't want to identify as that person that has a mental health condition. And one thing I advocate for in my work is moving from that framing of mental health condition to human condition. And just recognizing in our shared humanity, what brain science says is that we are not necessarily like, again, like a person that has depression or is labeled with depression. And that's like a set fixed thing. But rather, any of us in the human spectrum are likely to vacillate in and out of episodes throughout our life, episodes of anxiety spectrum, depression spectrum. And that's just part of brain chemistry and also the sheer forces of life in our social context. So I think just one is identity around, it doesn't mean you're weak or you're not strong or you're not smart. And by the way, I think a lot of people who are very highly intelligent are among the most anxious in our species. You know, I love the work of Robert Sapolsky, who talks a lot about almost like we're going to think ourselves to like such that stew, right, of anxiety. So I think we have to remember in our identity that, again, as human beings, we can just make sure that like being smart means like being strategic and being proactive. And it's not a moral failing or anything like that. It's been framed historically. I think the second thing, I love how you said like the small things add up. And so that makes me think of like cumulative effect. So the idea that as we maneuver through this incredibly excruciating life with all the fears and angst that's at hand, right? And we're trying to make sense of it and trying to make our way through it. you know, that can erode the quality of our lives. That erodes our mental health. When we look at the data right now in light of COVID and all the things that be, we are dealing with a significant, you know, crisis of our mental health. And so again, like, it's a risk of today to be out living to, you know, where this is the storm we're living in. And, you know, we need our umbrellas, so to speak. And I think with cumulative effect, just like all that stuff, you know, whether it's what's coming across the constant news cycle or our feeds or what's happening at work and all the adjustments that are required of us, that has a cumulative erosive effect on our mental health. So to stay fit mentally, we need to also make those small deposits in our own bank. You know, we need to make sure that self-care becomes a priority. And it's not touchy-feely, kumbaya, oh, mani-pedi, like treat yourself kind of thing. I think a lot of people have, when they hear self-care, they think it's like kind of wishy-washy or touchy-feely. But a cumulative effect, like you said, it's like sleep, right? But then it's like, well, how do I then put a good sleep hygiene in place? What's the science behind that? And what are some small steps I can take to make sure the quality of my sleep is better? Because that's a huge leg in my stool of self-care. Or movement. Okay, how do I then be creative to get on my calendar, even though I have like 8 Zoom meetings back to back? Like, what's that going to look like? Or, you know, in the age of, like, again, I hate the word social distancing. I think physical distancing is more helpful. But how do I stay connected when there's these health risks writ large? So I think just thinking from that cumulative effect, like the little things do make a big difference. And it's what we call break rituals. You know, that's a way towards mental fitness and resilience. Is like, it's not like, you know, I always think like, don't wait till your next vacation. You know, like what's going to happen? First of all, I mean, like travel is hard right now, but waiting for our next vacation to unwind, that's the classic thing. Well, once this deadline's over, once I jump through these 18 hoops, then I'll be able to relax. Well, that doesn't happen because you go on vacation, you get sick, someone throws up on you, you break your ankle, the cruise ship sinks. Like those magical moments that we muster up in our mind's eye rarely are the full source of recalibration that we need. And the idea when we think about preventing burnout, staying fit and staying resilient is that cumulative effect of like each day we do those little things very deliberately that help us recalibrate and help sustain us. And I think, you know, so many times we're just taught, wait for this like day at the spa, wait for this vacation, wait until you get this degree or you finish this deadline or you have a better boss or your kids are at a different stage where they're not waking you up in the night. But life is always bring us constant trade-offs in the stages of life. And that's why we have to be hyper-vigilant about our well-being practices that we put into play.
You mentioned life has these cumulative dramas. When you're a kid, you can run as fast as you want. When you're a teenager, you're still pretty energetic. But as you get older, you start to feel it, the little setbacks and stresses of life and, you know, things happen. You realize that you need to look after your body. And so we sort of know what we're doing there. But when it comes to our mental health, there's all these micro traumas or setbacks that we don't actually build resources for, like getting divorced or losing your job or a health issue or something out there like a pandemic. That's why we need mental fitness. That's why we need to turn self-care into stress recovery. Through life in a state of low-level exhaustion, semi-burnout, low effectiveness, when instead, if they recovered better, they might be more efficient or more effective rather than sort of being always on. A lot of people say that life's a marathon, but if you look at the work of Tony Schwartz and Jim Law, it's more of a series of sprints punctuated by periods of rest and recovery and self-care. So at Resilience Agenda, we have this idea that, you know, self-care is not a day spa or waiting for your next holiday, but instead it's more of a regular, habitual, daily thing. So what would you say to someone who's busy and who can't seem to make the time to focus on their self-care and well-being, maybe because they've got big project or something is happening at work or they've got a new child? How do you make well-being a priority when you've got aging parents or 3 kids or an unreasonable boss?
That's a great question. I think it's one that so many women specifically grapple with, but I think, you know, many people that are, again, very, very much conscientious, that are trying to show up and do their best in the roles that they occupy, you know, I think it can be, you know, just almost, it can feel impossible. Like where is the room for this? And again, I think that's why micro strategies are important, and ritualizing small things that are possible, you know, within the confines of one's own schedule, rather than thinking like it has to be this like, you know, full out 2 week holiday or getaway. But I will say this, I think as I've worked with women specifically, or anyone that's really struggling to find the space for self-care, one of the most important ways you could think about it is to give yourself permission. Because I think so many times we're conditioned to like, just feel like, you know, we have to be martyrs or we have to do all. And we see that as, again, a part of our identity as people, like, the, you know, just hitting out of the park with everything we do and being like that heroic worker or parent or son or daughter or whatever it is. Like, I think we have to rethink our identity and realize that we are not robots. We're not machines. We're not human doings. We're human beings. And that, you know, there's no health without mental health. It's not worth getting sick over. And it's really like, you know, that burnout risk of today. Again, burnout was reclassified. I don't know if you saw this, Hadley, but it was reclassified by WHO as a workplace condition of today rather than like a health issue. That was a major move. That was last year that happened, kind of pre-COVID. So, I mean, like, imagine now, like, the risk of today is burnout. And so, again, it's prudent to be like, I have to stay on top of this, and I have to give myself permission that, again, I don't have to wear my cape 24/7. Who is that serving? It's just leading me to this recipe of burnout and erosion of well-being. So I think it starts with permission, and then it starts, I think the next part is strategic action. Like, okay, so what is high resonance for me? Like, there's not a one-size-fits-all plan for self-care. So it's like, okay, for me, it might be meditation. For someone else, it might be a nice run on the beach, or, you know, so identifying like what are those activities, go-to activities, and then who are the go-to people in our lives? This is another big one, because relationships are known, as you know, to be amongst the most protective factors towards well-being and resilience. And we need people who will hold us accountable, that hold space for us, that we can trust, that are confidants, and that just, you know, keep us in that like realm of reminding ourselves of our worth and what kinds of actions we can take to protect ourselves. So I think that's a big piece. So it's permission, it's being strategic, it's finding community to help support you with it. And I think it's also learning the power of a two-letter word, which is no. What a novel concept, right? To actually say no to things, you know, like, I think in this hyper performance society, so I think of parents a lot, and I'm a parent myself. And I think about like, okay, it's like, you know, you have to be this like hyper parent, and we spend more time across the world with our kids than any generation past, but we feel the guiltiest that we're like depriving our kids of quality time. So we have all these like images of, you know, and like, just thinking from like a work perspective, like we're doing the work of multiple people. So I just think in general, like all those roles, it's like we take those on as identity, and it can trap us into thinking that if it's not perfect and if it's not like amplified, that it's not good enough. And we let these ideas of perfection become the enemy of just saying like it's good enough the way it is. And I also need to prioritize myself. And so I think just recognizing that, and recognizing, again, you don't need to necessarily do an overhaul and like quit your job, leave your family and go on like a 6-month sabbatical, but maybe it's okay to say no to certain things and to recognize that your time is sacred, that you actually use to preserve your well-being and cultivate your resilience.
I was keen to talk to you about perfection, opening up, and imposter syndrome. These are three topics you cover in your hilarious TED talk. We'll have to put a link to that in the show notes. In my own life, part of me, I guess I'm a perfectionist. I made a few mistakes a few weeks ago, and you know, that really sort of hit me. Another example is how I run a global health movement, but I'm not a psychologist, so sometimes I feel like an imposter. But of course, I've got all these different privileges as well, and imposter syndrome is especially can come up amongst minority communities or otherwise disadvantaged groups. Tell us more about these ideas.
Well, I think, you know, when we hear the word perfectionism, again, like words have certain connotations or trigger points for people. And you think like, oh, that I identify with that or I don't. But by definition, you know, it's seen as an intellectual form of self-doubt. So, and one thing that I think is really interesting to pay attention to is that in studies, they've shown in the past decade, the perfectionism has gone up by 33%. And one of the driving forces behind it is social comparison. So we do often compare ourselves, and especially in a hyper-competitive global market, and all, like, I think the social media bragging and, like, you know, just seeing everyone's curated lives on display, I think we have this illusion that everyone's lives are way better, they're way more successful and whatnot. So I think we have to really watch for that. And I also find it interesting / worrisome that social anxiety is the fastest growing anxiety spectrum issue of today. So people are feeling very awkward, very isolated, very lonely, very inadequate, and very much in that imposter syndrome kind of category. So I think first is recognizing that if you're a person who's experiencing a lot of self-doubt, negative self-talk, that toxic inner critic is kind of chirping at you, just to pay attention to that. Or if you find yourself comparing yourself to everyone and feeling like you're underaccomplished, it's something to really like kind of just stop and reframe and give yourself a checkpoint with. And then with imposter syndrome, that whole feeling like I'm a fraud, I'm a phony, someone's going to find me out, I'm not good enough, I didn't deserve this promotion or this job or my place at the table or at the university. Unfortunately, that's a situation that is disproportionately affects Black people, people of color, women, first generation students, professionals, anyone in underrepresented, minority, underserved group. That kind of condition is even deeply, you know, more deeply intensified. And I think what we have to do as drivers, as people who are trying to, whether we're trying to have upward mobility or we're trying to, you know, bring impact in society as leaders, or we're just trying to, you know, be well and keep our families well, whatever like it is, I think a lot of times we can feel like, you know, inadequate. And I think, again, just talking back to that and recognizing, well, wow, you know, in my TED talk, I talk about ASSEs. And that's, you know, every academic, we love our metaphors, we love our acronyms. But ASSEs is asinine, self-imposed, and societal expectations, right? And it's like taking those ASSEs out, so to speak. It's like, we can't live in this whole, like, weird space of thinking like everything, what we see is what we get. And that, again, like, that if we do this, we'll be successful. If these letters are after our name, or if our kids, like, you know, turn out with this job, or what, you know, the car we drive, or the money in the bank, what science has actually shown is those illusions of success actually generally, like, sabotage us. And they also, when we get to them, like, whatever those ideas are, like, we actually, that doesn't make for happiness. Happiness is characterized by self-compassion, compassion for one another, deep presence, deep regard for each other. Again, moving from the me, like the hyper-performance, to the we, which is consciousness, collective consciousness. And I think that was like kind of emblematic in the TED Talk. It's like, we can all, you know, put on airs and try to seem like we have it together, but who does? You know, and that's something I felt very called to in my public work as a person with a lived experience with anxiety, as a person in a position of power with privilege, and knowing the modern brain science and advocating strongly against stigma, why am I going to hide out? And that was kind of, you know, a moment for me in my trajectory where I became much more forthcoming in my writing and my speaking and my leadership to say, like, hello, like, who else is scared? Like, raise, you know, like, we're all feeling this way. And it's just part of the human condition. It doesn't mean you're weak or you're a loser or you're whatever. Like, you know, it's just part of life. So I think for any of us, it's me letting go of perfectionism was being more honest, integrating the different sides of my story, recognizing that you can't just say, well, I don't want my anxiety anymore. My anxiety has fueled, it's been like a frenemy to me. It's been like a best friend in some ways because it reflects my conscientiousness. It motivates me. It gives me that adrenaline I need. But if I'm not tending to it, it can take over and be really destructive. So I think that, you know, and that's what I talk about in intelligence is the integration of the different sides of our story. On one hand, you can be like very well accomplished and you can have been meeting your goals and feeling good about life. And on the other hand, you can be a hot mess. You can be afraid. You can be waking up in the night, like sick to your stomach. And that's just all part of the same experience. It's not one isn't good and bad. It's just part of our experiences.
Do you find that you can get this message through to everyone? Most of us would say that happiness is a goal in our lives. Or they might say, I don't have time to be happy. Or other things are more important, like looking after my family or getting the job done. Is asking these sort of questions only something that white, privileged, work from home, well-educated, people who read books can ask? Or is this something that, you know, everyone can experience?
I think it's a very deep question. I think it is one that really like begs us to think deeply. And a favorite quote of mine is by Alvin Toffler, who says that the illiterate of the 21st century will not be those who cannot read and write, but those who cannot learn, unlearn, and relearn. And I think when we think about happiness, again, it's been propagated as a me thing. Like as long as me and my tribe, people who look like me, think like me, love like me, associate, affiliate with me, that's who I need to worry about. What I found in my research and what I feel very strongly about is happiness is collective. And I talk about this as collective efficacy in mentelligence. It's the idea that when you do well, I do well. When you hurt, I hurt. And an injury to one is an injury to all. So again, when we have these social ills and when we have, especially like when it comes to income inequalities, and again, just like the power over dynamics across governments and just these ways of operating that really marginalize, oppress, discriminate, and create violence against especially Black lives, but also many marginalized and underrepresented groups. That's a situation that we're never going to get to like happiness until we address those deeper issues. What I will also say in terms of rethinking or unlearning on the notion of happiness. Again, happiness is something that becomes, again, this collective community. And it's when we are flourishing as people in ways that we've been able to dislodge from what society says is happiness. Because, you know, when we think of capitalism or we think about what I call in my writing, the commodity complex, it's the idea that stuff equals happiness. The identity is based on, again, our status and how people perceive us and what we amass and what we hoard and what we have. None of that is actually proven from the science or shows up in ways that actually protect us and help us be resilient or mentally fit even. It doesn't produce happiness, but think about it, Hadley. It's like a kid, before they lose their first tooth, they're already thinking about where they're going to college. By the time they're in third grade, they think they need to be reading three grade levels ahead. By the time they're in college, high school, they have to be taking 10 AP classes and all these extracurricular activities. And then by the time college comes, they think they have to have their own startup to be successful. So I worry about this messaging around identity that breeds a lot of unhappiness. Like, what about kids just playing? And then what about like those notions of kindness? Like, why do I want this to happen if I'm in a position of privilege for myself, if this directly is marginalizing and oppressing other groups, you know? And I think this is something that we have to really hold like in the collective, like happiness isn't for the sake of self. And so many of the ideals that are being sold are like inhumane, unjust, archaic, and just flat out straight up wrong. Like they're erroneous, you know? So that's kind of, you know, my mission in the TED Talk and in the book and Mentelligence is like, here's a new psychology of how we conceptualize well-being and happiness and how we need to say no more. Like we can't continue these traditions in society of suffering and expect like, oh, we can just then compartmentalize little pockets of privilege that do well and think that that's going to be sustainable. It's not.
Let's talk about Mentelligence. Talk us through what it's all about.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm obviously a word nerd, so I like to fuse the words together. But one thing that happened in my research, I did a grounded theory research study. So this is the underpinning of the book with high achievers, emerging leaders who are really striving to like make it in this world and struggling with the things we've been talking about, like integrating the sides of your story, owning your story, focusing on the we, not the me. So when we think of the word mental, you know, what do you think of when you hear mental?
These days, it's anything mind related, but in the past, it's about doing something crazy on the news.
Yeah, right. So I love it because you've already undergone like that rethinking it process. So it is, it's like mental health, mental disorder, mental issue. So that piece needs to be dismantled. And then intelligence. And I think, you know, Howard Gardner obviously has been a leader in that space around like reconceptualize what it means to be intelligent. And what I found too, when I look at emotional intelligence, because I have to say like, I religiously taught it in my classes. I've always like lived and breathed it. But one of the issues with the EI framework is it's not necessarily culturally competent and responsive. So it really advocates for more of an individualistic lens versus a collective lens. And then it also, from a cultural standpoint, it can teach someone to hide their emotions and to use emotional intelligence to manipulate people. And so that was something I call out in Mentelligence and offering kind of this new psychology and this new model of thinking about collective efficacy, of thinking about, again, movement from me to we. And first, again, you know, in the book, I talk about every session that I provide. So my chapters are called sessions. And it each starts off with this metaphor and acronym of spiraling up. Okay. So it's unlearning one form of indoctrination and pivoting towards another for that upward spiral. And in the research, like think about like you always hear about a downward spiral. Oh, like, you know, someone, this happened, the next thing you know, there's this catastrophic avalanche of issues. But we as a species are wired for upward spiraling. So in other words, creating positive emotion repertoires, not superficial happiness, like emojis and yay, you know, you can do anything, but it's actually emotional states that we can create and then build a whole repertoire around to help us harness momentum, even in the face of adversity and heightened stressors. So Mentelligence is just about that. Like, how do we spiral up? How do we unlearn, whether it's like ideas about gender or race, or it's ideas about hyper-performance or how we view ourselves around perfectionism. So each section of the book provides a lot of exercises and opportunities for unlearning and relearning, ways that, again, the science supports and ways that are all about moving to a better place together, moving from the me to the we, you know, and that's just something like you can tell I get hype about it. I'm like, wow, like it never grows old because I think there's just so much that we're sold that's so destructive to our mind, body, and soul. And I've seen it in my therapy room. I've seen it in my classroom. I've seen it in boardrooms. I work with organizations from around the world. And so many times people are struggling because what our systems have been built on is a deficit model, a downward spiral model, a model of meanness and push each other aside and be polarized and fight. And, you know, we'll never find common ground. And yet as a species, we have metacognition. Like we can think about thinking, we are capable of this, and it's just a matter of stopping and reconfiguring and then working through it together. I'm super hopeful, but in the book, I'll just end by saying, I use a term called skeptimist. So it's again, my nerdy word fusion, right? But I'm skeptical and optimistic at the same time. I'm skeptical that we're being sold these things by politicians and marketers and are the feeds that are coming through that aren't right. And they're not really true versions of success, but I'm optimistic that we can wake up and say, this isn't right. And I'm going to forge a new path and I'm going to pull people along with me. And we're going to find this new psychology, this new way of being, that science really shows helps us to stay mentally fit, resilient, in community. It helps us heal through all kinds of trauma. And it just helps us get to a better place, you know, and that's what, you know, scientists call the good life. The good life isn't money in the bank and all the stuff in the songs and this and that. The good life is that we're okay with ourselves. We're okay with each other. And that we're mindful and we're present and we're in awe of life and we're grateful for life and we can celebrate what is and work to fix what isn't. And that's, you know, impact, social impact is what really elevates us.
Speaking of skepticism, this might have been great in theory or 6 months ago, but now, you know, I'm at a workplace where my livelihood is on the line, but being real is too risky and they think it's just not worth it.
I mean, you know, my position, my talk is called The Risk You Must Take. And I agree. I think that I'm not advocating for bringing your journals to work and showing everybody or giving a play-by-play on your therapy session. I think there's not a one-size-fits-all to calculated risk, but I think it starts with identifying who in your life is safe, who is an ally, who is someone that shows up authentically and like a true authentic. Like I say in the talk, I'm like, authentic is the new BS. Like there's authentic leadership, authentic parenting, authentic living. Like it's becoming trite. So if you see someone that exemplifies, like they're okay with their so-called weaknesses or mistakes, and they're not afraid to own like the totality of themselves, that's a good start, like forming those connections with people. Because I think then that lends itself to ongoing evolution and growth. And then that knowledge of like where and when and how you can show up in more nuanced ways, in ways that aren't airbrushed and polished, and you're bleaching out the messy parts of your story, and you're living in fear, and I'm an imposter, and oh my gosh, they're going to find me out. I mean, I have to say, the first time I came out with my own mental health story was in front of all of my colleagues, okay? So I'm not saying everyone should copy this example because it was a little wild. Like I had my PowerPoint, I had my script, and then I'm like, I'm done. Like, I'm not going to like just talk about my data points and my white papers and this and that. And I just went off script and I just spoke from the heart. And I remember after I did it, I was like, oh, are people going to, you know, like, am I going to get fired? What's my boss going to think? Are people going to think I'm weird? Oh my, right? And then I go back to the office and everyone's hugging me and they're like, thank you for saying that. You know, that's exactly how I feel, but I was afraid. And that was kind of like just a pivotal moment in my own way of showing up. And I think since then, it's been like unreal, like the community across the world and like the relationships I have, because I think when we do that for one another, it creates a sense of safety. Now, in all of our work environments, there can be all kinds of different ways a work culture is. It can be very rigid. It can be more inclusive. It can be open. So I'm not saying like, just go ahead and, you know, just get up and give your own version of a presentation. But what I am saying is, even for like the most skeptical of environments or hard-nosed environments, in today's world, we're talking more than ever about mental fitness and mental health. We now have hard data, science behind us that says cultures that promote higher levels of trust, higher senses of belonging, higher senses of safety, do better. And when we attend to mental health and well-being in the work environment, you know, it's just, it's a win-win for everybody. So I think, you know, finding space, you know, creating allies and relationships and seeing what you can advocate for, that maybe your company needs to unlearn punitive behavior and power over structures and hierarchy. Maybe that hierarchy needs to get flattened. Or maybe the inequities that have always been, we blow the whistle and say they can't happen anymore. And I think when we start to dismantle that stuff, it can ease up on the more deeper interpersonal kinds of ways that we want to see manifest in our work environments. So I'm not saying just like caution to the wind in every situation unequivocally. That's, and especially not as a white woman, because I think of my friends of color and colleagues of color, like, that's also something you have to be very cautious about if you're already living the experience of marginalization and oppression, you know, being careful. But I think we all have to work together to say, what could we do to shift this idea that, like, let's say you have a culture that's like 80 hours on and it's stigmatized if you're not like, you know, like just cranking all the time. Brain science shows we need respite and we need breaks and we need creativity and innovation to work smarter and more strategically. But we have to watch out for burnout. So I think there's a lot we can do to advocate. And I think the more we unhook from it all, we can then form those kinds of alliances and relationships that help us to self-advocate and collectively advocate for change. But I think at minimum in your personal life, working to find people you can be yourself with. And think about it. I mean, Hadley, I don't know about you, but I feel like in so many of my closest friendships, it's when one of us like acknowledge some kind of strife we experience, that becomes a bonding force. It's like, oh my gosh, me too. Like, I get that. I feel that. That's been my experience too. And the humor that can come about because of that and the bonding that can come about it. It's like, we're all feeling this way. And I think the person who says it is like the hero sometimes.
We have a lot of people listening in who have leadership roles or in HR. And we know it's important for leaders to model these behaviors. It's hard to do these things, however, if you're new or if you're a person of color. But if you're an established leader, you can do more of this and really set the example. So what's your advice to leaders who get mental health or who get the big picture, who, when they start thinking about who they want to be at work and the kind of change they can make, what are two or three things that people can bring with them to bring people with them and to make a change?
Yeah, and you know, I have the privilege of working with HR professionals and leaders across the world. And what I just see is an overwhelming call for leaders, you know, to work towards their own authenticity, you know, to show up real, you know, to really demonstrate care for their employees, for those that they're influencing and leading and serving. So I think just that spirit of humility, you know, not having that heavy hand in a punitive way, being honest about one's own vulnerabilities. And then the last thing I'll say is aligning values to behavior. In Mentelligence, I reference the Values in Action Inventory by Marty Seligman, who's the father of positive psychology. And this really aligns with a lot of the research that I've done is, you know, if we know our values and we're aligning them to our behavior, we're going to be in our best vibration. We're going to be in alignment. And that's going to be infectious. That's going to have a contagion effect on everyone we're influencing that's around us. So I think just really knowing ourselves, knowing our strengths, how do we capitalize on those? And I think that role modeling just goes so far. And, you know, obviously how we communicate, how we listen. I feel like so many times for those I've led in various situations across my career, a lot of times people will just say, thank you for seeing me. So as a leader, as a professional, don't underestimate the value of just seeing someone, seeing their beauty, their worth, their value, their strengths, and just reflecting that. We're like mirrors to each other. And when we can reflect, you know, that picture back to someone and help them capitalize on that, that's really when we all flourish together.
So what's next for positive psychology? People who know it, know it. Many, there are many out there who don't know it or think it's something esoteric. What do you think's next in mental health and well-being in general?
I think one of the things that I believe society is driving us towards is, you know, sustainable practical applications of it within varied environments and with varied audiences. And I think, again, like, what I really hope will keep coming to bear is not decontextualizing well-being. And what I mean by that is a very contextualized understanding of the interplay of the isms and social ills on well-being and how those have to simultaneously be addressed. You know, we can't like just have our little pop psychology 1, 2, 3 mindfulness activities and call it a day. I think we need to go deeper. And I think with positive psychology, the science of human flourishing and looking at what causes people to do well, again, we have amazing science that really shows, you know, facets of self-compassion, of gratitude, of mindfulness practice. And again, making sure those get integrated into daily practice and we have practical applications, I think is going to be vital. And like any scientific discipline, helping a big thing that I think Mentelligence embodies and I feel very strongly about is making sure that it's not watered down and fluffy so that people can digest it. I think we need to go deeper and again, like really use critical thinking lenses to say, who's saying it? Why are they saying it? What do they have to benefit? And making sure that the things that we adopt, again, have that holistic lens within our own sphere, but also writ large. So I think we're going to just see a lot of that much more dynamic and nuanced conversation with regards to race and class and gender and orientation and age. And like from a generational perspective, I think there's a lot we can integrate and leverage. So I think, you know, we're going to see a lot of that. And we're just going to see more and more science, like, affirm what a lot of these ancient traditions such as mindfulness have known for over 2,000 years, which I think is exciting. For my own research, I've been really interested in kind of the intersections of psychology and spirituality as well. And I think those are very oftentimes very polarized camps. And like looking at, again, how many of us don't subscribe to like religious like organizations per se, but we are humanistic or we have spiritual practices such as mindfulness, and kind of learning how those can be elevating to the mind, body, and soul, and how those practices, again, really bring about collective efficacy.
So who inspires you?
Yeah, so someone that inspires me a lot is Bernie Sanders. He just, I think, really embodies the whole we movement and the idea, again, of making sure we're making equitable systems come to bear. So he's someone that inspires me immensely, and also kind of connected. I kind of connect, like Noam Chomsky has always been someone that I just have found, like, just for years, like I've always had an intellectual crush on him.
Can we talk about men's health? Many of our supporters are women and often get asked by some of them, how can they talk to their partners about mental health without putting them off or without them shutting down? I guess the question is, how can women help their partners open up around mental health in a new way?
Yeah, I think it's a beautiful question. I think, again, it's about like unlearning stigma and careful phrasing on communication. So it's like, well, if it's in the heat of the moment, you're like, you need help, or, you know, I think that can make someone kind of shut down. I think, again, normalizing that we all struggle and we can always improve our mental fitness, just like we can always improve our physical fitness. Like, you could eat really healthy, but there's probably always another tweak you could do. Or when it comes to physical fitness, so you could be fit, but it's like, you're not saying, oh, you're obese and you're like in terrible shape, if you're saying you could get a little bit more fit to someone that might need that tweak, or they might need a bigger intervention. So I think it's just by starting showing that you care, not in the heat of the moment, you know, and not in a critical way, but like, wow, like, you know, let's be proactive in our relationship. Let's try to go to some of these mental fitness strategies or resilience bolstering strategies. Let's see it as something that is a modern epidemic today. Burnout is being called the occupational risk or the new normal. Like, so it's like we're all subject to this kind of stress. And I think in general, like, we all know that. It's just a matter of, again, saying, okay, what are those high resonance things that we could do? And I think the other thing is with therapy, a lot of people have these weird ideas about therapy being like an excavation of childhood skeletons, or I'm going to be in trouble, I'm going to be in the hot seat. And that's not what therapy is. Therapy is evidence-based, it's strategic, it's a safe, confident space where someone can kind of unpack things and then strategically construct a well-being plan. So I think it's just maybe little articles, videos, you know, providing them different, I think TED Talks are great, you know, just all those little things, podcasts like this, where then you hear people's stories and you're like, all right, if this person who has a degree in this field and they're an expert, they're having a hard time, it's okay for me to have a hard time too. And it's not like, you know, a failing here. So I think that the more we can actually share stories, I think there's a tremendous benefit and power to that.
This has been great. Tell us about your website or where we can learn more about you.
Yeah, you can find me at KristenLee.com, and you can just find a little bit more of the backstory, and you can find different resources and articles there. You can also find me on social media at The Real Dr. Chris, not the fake Dr. Chris. And The Real Dr. Chris with a K. And you'll see there, I do a lot of videos. I actually have a YouTube channel too with meditations and different different talks there. So Dr. Chris at YouTube, at The Real Dr. Chris at Insta, Twitter, all the things. And feel free to DM and reach out, you know, find me on LinkedIn if you want. I know that's where we connected, but it's a, you know, there's plenty of things I have out there. And then I do a lot of webinars and visits to companies and organizations and schools on this rethinking process and on helping, you know, with Mentelligence in respective places. So I'm not hard to find.
And where can we get your book?
You can get the book at Amazon or where local booksellers are sold. But again, it's called Mentelligence, A New Psychology of Thinking. Learn what it takes to be more agile, mindful, and connected in today's world.
Thank you, Kristen, so much for coming on today. and for sharing your work with us.
My pleasure, Hadley. Take great care.
That was Kristen Lee, psychologist, therapist, author, TED talker, and all-round resilience guru. You can learn more about what we spoke about in the show notes at resilienceagenda.com. Remember, you can join us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, the Resilience Agenda website, or your favorite podcasting platform. Feel free to follow us on Facebook and Instagram by searching Resilience Agenda and sign up for occasional updates and strategies to build your mental fitness, www.resilienceagenda.com. If you enjoyed this podcast, please follow us so you'll never miss a new episode. Leave us a review online or share Resilience Agenda Radio with your friends so they can learn more about the Mental Fitness Toolkit and hear more from our lineup of world-renowned experts and storytellers. Until next time, I'm Hadley Fisher, and thanks for listening in to Resilience Agenda Radio.